wonderful listeners. This is Katie in freezing cold Paris. I hope you're wrapped up warm wherever you are. I don't know if you've had time yet to listen to this week's episode, Making Peace with the Wolves, but if you have, you'll have heard our guest, Alexandra Pascalidou, the Greek-Swedish journalist, telling the incredible story of how she met up with a former neo-Nazi who'd been sending her abuse for years and years, and how she decided to forgive him. This is our full conversation with Alexandra. We just ended up talking about so many different things that we thought we'd dish it up to you as our first ever bonus episode. So, if you're interested in what makes the Swedish far right tick, if you're interested in European identity, if you're interested in Eurovision even, it's definitely worth a listen. As with the shorter version in this week's main episode, we just wanted to warn you that it does include a discussion of some pretty horrible threats made against Alexandra. But honestly, I challenge you not to come out of listening to this actually feeling a tiny bit more hopeful about humanity.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi, Alexandra. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm trying to be fine. But it's okay. How are you doing?
Listen, we're both also a little bit sick. We can take sneezing breaks every couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And where are you? Are you based in Paris or where are you?
I'm in Paris and Dominic is in Amsterdam.
So oh my God. What a European podcast.
Well, it does what it says on the tin.
I know. And we thought you were the perfect guest because you have such a pan-European background as well.
I really do. And I love Europe, even if there are some problems here and there.
Yeah.
It is an amazing place. And actually, Alexandra, while I was doing some research, I didn't realize that you'd presented Eurovision one year, which is amazing. What was that like?
In fact, I presented Eurovision, you know, the contest in both Greece and Sweden the same year, 2005.
No way.
The same year?
Yes, I presented Melodifestivalen in Sweden and I presented the Greek version of the Eurovision contest. And then I was a commentator in Kiev. And that was the first year ever that Greece won. And the singer was a friend of mine and she's also Greek-Swedish. Helena Paparizou, and it was like the craziest, the funniest adventure ever, because before we did this, we traveled around Europe from Andorra to Moscow to all the, you know, to so many countries that participated to promote the song and to, yeah, mostly to promote the song. And it was fascinating to meet all the artists from the other countries and have time to spend time with them. So it made my work easier when I wrote the script for that night as a commentator. It was great. It was great. And I really think I love the Eurovision.
So do we. We can't wait for it to come around so we can do like 3 special episodes just about Eurovision.
Amazing. It's amazing.
I think we should put in an entry one year, Dominic.
Do you?
Yeah, like a sort of dual nationality. Well, 3 nations. I think that would be lovely.
It's mostly 2 nations for me because, you know, I was born in Romania just by coincidence. My parents happened to live there and they left Romania after 1 year only. So I don't really have a relationship to Romania more than it was my parents' secret language.
Aha.
When they were arguing, they used the Romanian language. And when I many, many years later studied Latin at school, I was like, why is this so easy for me? And then I found out that I had it in my head since I was a kid. You know, the Romanian language is based on the Latin language. And when I did this documentary about the Roma beggars in Europe and traveled with them, I could easily communicate with them thanks to the Romanian, the secret language, and the Latin.
Wow. That is amazing. But these days, do you think of yourself as like 50% Greek, 50% Swedish, both at the same time? How do you think of yourself?
I think of myself as at 200%, 100% Greek and 100% Swedish. And there are days that I feel like 1% and 2%, you know, it depends. And it depends on where I am and what situations. And identity is very much based on how you're treated and how other people see you. So it's not only how you define yourself. So there are moments that people see me as very Greek only because I happen to be very emotional at the moment. And I'm like, my God, why do you call this being Greek? You know, so it's a daily discussion and a daily debate within me.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I really find the European identity so you know, deliberating. It makes me feel so free because I can be European and it's like the sum of all my identities somehow.
That's really nice.
That is really nice. And actually, we've been trying to explore this concept of European identity over the last 12 episodes that we've been doing that. And that's one of the nicest definitions of it we've had yet, I think.
Most people don't have a definition of it. I mean, even me, you know, like I live in France, I love Europe, but I don't know what it means to be European. And that's part of the reason why we wanted to make this show.
Yeah, and you know, back in the early 90s, I wrote an essay at university and I wrote about European identity. I remember my professor told me, but European identity, there is not such thing. I mean, you can't write about this. This will be very hard. But it was something that was under construction and there were like some wishes around and it was, but it was far, far away. It was like something that people didn't really think will happen. But today it's so funny because I really find myself describing and feeling as a European. And I think that there are many people with migrant backgrounds that see Europe being a symbol of a more open space for different identities.
Yeah.
But the problem is with the European identity is that some of us have advantages in front of others. You know, the advantages, for example, right now, your English is great and English has become the lingua franca
yes.
of Europe, which means there are moments I feel like a kid intellectually because I'm not really able to put words in all these great thoughts that I have. So that's a problem which demands that we should like promote the English language much more in schools. So yeah. We are more equal, all of us.
Or I think just foreign languages in general. Here in France, the government is like trying to promote this idea that more and more kids do the Erasmus program, which I think would be amazing. You know, I never did it. I wish I had done. I think it's a great opportunity just to get out there and experience another culture, which so many kids never get to have.
I did it.
You did.
I was so privileged because I got the Erasmus scholarship and I studied in Greece at a Greek university during 1 year. And that opened the doors back to Greece so I could work for Greek TV during 2 years. And it's only thanks to Erasmus. It also helped me, you know, finding my identity and finding my place. And it was so funny because when I came to Greece, I felt so extremely Greek. I grew up in a very poor suburb in Sweden with Greek parents. I went to a Greek school and everything. And people saw me and described me as a Greek. And then suddenly I come to Greece to study in my home country. And everybody calls me the Swede. And everybody
yeah.
and everybody thinks I'm very, very Swedish. And I also find everything happening at this little university in Crete so awkward, so different. And I'm like, oh my God. Then I realize I'm Swedish.
Wow.
So it's so interesting, Erasmus. And I was very happy because last year I received an award for, you know, they had like 30 years of Erasmus. So Juncker handed out an award to me and two other guys who did the Erasmus. And mm-hmm. we got the opportunity to give a speech at the European Parliament and the Commission. So I met so many people that done the Erasmus and it really changed their lives.
Yeah, I mean, even Juncker, we talked about statistic last year. I think Juncker said, what was the figure, Dominic?
He claims that there've been 1 million babies born due to the Erasmus scheme, which is extraordinary.
I'm not sure it's true, but it is a lovely number.
Exactly. No, it's fantastic.
It's so nice to hear you speak so positively about Europe, but also you've had some quite hard times in Europe. One of the reasons why we wanted to talk to you was because of your amazing article about speaking to your ex-neo-Nazi tormentor. I was wondering if you could just give our listeners a quick outline of how this meeting came about.
You know, as a journalist and as a public figure in Sweden since 1995, I have received so many threats on a daily basis, mainly from racists and Nazis threatening to kill me, to hurt me in different ways, to do terrible things, to torture me. They've been threatening me with rape and everything, mostly because I'm from another origin. I'm a migrant. I'm a working class kid from the poor suburb, and I was standing up for human rights. And back in late 90s, I had Nazis masked with weapons outside my home.
Oh my God.
And this was published in the biggest newspaper in Sweden, Aftonbladet. And it became a huge scandal. So I was in court for 1 year or something. So I had different incidents with Nazis during the years. And there have been periods where I just took time out and left the country. I went to Latin America for 3 months. And I was so afraid. And I didn't really get the support from the police, I have to say. So after so many years of this, what can I call it, with this fight, I received three letters within 1 month, three emails from three different men. Wow. And yeah, it was amazing. It was last September. And two of these men have just listened to my first book, Beyond Mom Street. It's an autobiography. And it was released on audiobook. So they listened and they were like, I'm so sorry. I feel ashamed. I now have kids and I don't want anything like this happening to them. And they didn't leave me any numbers or they didn't ask to meet or anything. The third letter was like, hi, I'm Marty. I'm writing to you because I want to ask forgiveness. And I've directed so much hate against you over many, many years. I called you late night telling you I was going to do terrible things and so on. And I just want you to know that I've left the Nordic resistance movement, the Nazi movement. So that's it. And he left a number. As soon as I read the email, I called him because I felt so optimistic suddenly. I felt so happy that there is somebody who regrets what mm-hmm. he's done. And this. So I called him and I was like, hi, can we meet? I'd love to meet you and hear more about your journey and what you've done and how you reached the point to ask forgiveness. And he was like, yeah, okay. And I found out he's like in a city very far away from Stockholm, like 4 hours on a train. And when I told my friends, they were like, oh my God, you're so naive. Perfect possibility for this guy to kill you. I mean, you know, you go there and it's a trap. But then, I'm a freelance journalist and I mentioned it for a newspaper, Dagens Nyheter. They were like, yeah, why don't you write about it? So I met Martin, the demon, the guy who poisoned 30 years, you know, being a mother and a single mother, having like phone calls at night when you put your daughter to bed, having a voice, a male voice whispering, I know you're at home with your daughter and I'm coming to slaughter you now.
Oh my God.
And without any protection, without anybody backing you up or something. It feels terrible, but I listened to him. I was very interested and I tried to not be that private person that was like struggling to survive at night and pretend in front of my daughter that everything is fine. There is no reason to be afraid of anything and we are safe because we live in one of the most robust democracies in the world. Mm-hmm. And at the same time being scared to death. So when I met Martin, I tried to be the journalist. I tried to take a step back.
And what were your first impressions of him?
Like, it was very hard because I couldn't even breathe. But what I felt was like that this guy is a vulnerable person. He has not really landed yet in his new identity. Because if your identity is based on hate and darkness and extremism and violence, it's very hard from one day to another to go from darkness to light. So I could tell that he was like trying to find himself in this new role. And what made the biggest impression was that he was very honest. You know, he answered all my questions about how they worked, how they radicalized themselves, how they saw the world. Being a homosexual, it was a disease and they had to be erased from earth, and how they saw the Jews, the Muslims, the women, the role of the women, and why they hated me and other people like me, and how they learned to use weapons, and how they formed groups where they were so enthusiastic and empowered each other for threatening people, famous people or people that in their own small cities or the surroundings or wherever that were different, and how they tried to break people. And then they were like celebrating that. They were celebrating silence. They were celebrating when somebody left or withdraw. And to have the possibility as a journalist and as a citizen to see this very planned and very sophisticated action, you know, it was fascinating. And I think it teaches us a lot about these kinds of movements that we have not only in Sweden. We have them around Europe and they're growing, unfortunately.
I think the Swedish Nazi movement seems to be particularly visible. They go on these big marches with their green and black flags and everything. People think of Sweden outside Sweden as a very tolerant country. Why do you think this movement is so big and has been growing?
It's terrible. And, you know, I think Sweden is generally a very tolerant country. We are a welfare country. We're a democracy that promotes equality. And it's easier to be a woman, a working woman here in Sweden. But we still have so many problems that we don't really talk about. And it's not forbidden to be organized in a Nazi movement in Sweden. Sometimes we think that tolerance is about tolerating Nazi expressions and other extreme opinions like that. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, I mean, you mentioned the march, the last march, the huge march we had outside the book fair in Gothenburg. Nazis were marching with pictures. One of these pictures was mine.
Yeah.
So we went to the police, some of us, and nothing happened because the police said that they could not identify these men carrying these pictures of the targets. It was embarrassing to get that answer because there is so much filmed material, there are so many photos, and Martin told me, I can identify all these guys, and there are so many journalists that can identify them. So I think that we've had quite a naive view on these groups, and somehow we think they can't do much damage. But the history and the facts show us the opposite. Yeah. They have murdered people, even policemen. I mean, we had like Alexander murders. We have Jon Hron. We have so many people that have been murdered by convinced Nazis here in Sweden, which should lead to much more serious work when it comes to these groups.
Yeah.
Just to mention, 3 weeks ago, I was invited to Ludvika, a small, beautiful city in the northern of Sweden, to give a speech on a very provocative topic, democracy and diversity. And the police called me and told me, you know, we have to pick you up at another train station. You can't get off at Ludvika, so we have to pick you up earlier because the building is surrounded. This was like early morning, minus 10 degrees. And there were 150 people in different ages that were coming to listen to me. But the police said, we can't really have you coming there alone because more than 20 neo-Nazis in uniforms have surrounded the building just to stop you and stop people coming to listen to you. So I gave the speech finally. The police had to hide me and, you know, I had to go through a back door. It was like, it was absurd. In Sweden, 2018. And then I gave this speech, not controversial at all, like referring to the Declaration for Human Rights, you know, the United Nations Declaration for Human Rights and, you know, things like that. And then I had to leave from a back door watching these men screaming outside, like 20, 25 men in black.
Ugh.
It was crazy, you know.
That's so depressing. Man, it's depressing.
So clearly something's not working out right with the authorities, and there needs to be more done to stop these neo-Nazis having a voice and having space to express themselves like this. But also, I was struck in your article about when Martin decided he wanted to repent and leave the community. He reached out to the authorities to see if there was any help he could get, and there wasn't any. They basically turned him away, and eventually he had to go to an anti anti-fascist organization where he was able to find some help. Through this experience, has it got you to thinking about how best to help them, yeah, recover?
You know, I was wondering, what if Martin was a jihadist?
Yeah.
And if he called the authorities and nobody helped? I was wondering if they would react in the same way, or nobody helped him. So I think that, for example, we have the Swedish church doing a great work, being very open. I think that we should really be open to these guys who are ready to leave extremism behind. It's very hard, but one of the things that made an impression on me was when he started wearing swastikas at school, being like 16, 17, 18, being a teenager, not even his teachers draw a line or, you know, put a limit and said, yeah, hello, what are you wearing? You're not supposed to wear that in a school.
That's crazy.
So I think as an adult, as a human being, as a citizen, whatever, you don't need to be a journalist or a policeman or a teacher, an authority, but we have to show that tolerance has its limits. Freedom of expression and freedom of speech also has its limits. Hate speech is not legal. It's a crime. And that's what we have to show, all of us, in our daily lives, and we have to practice that. So I think that is the beginning, that we're too tolerant with intolerant movements like that, spreading hate and hate leading to violence in so many different ways.
Sweden's seen a lot of asylum seekers arriving over the last few years as part of this huge wave of people arriving in Europe. And I know the neo-Nazis have attacked asylum seekers' shelters. Are there any efforts in Sweden to stop migrants from becoming the target of these neo-Nazis?
No, you know, we have elections in September, so the debate is not about protecting the asylum seekers. The debate is, unfortunately, about how to stop refugees coming to Europe, and especially to Sweden, and how to protect ourselves from refugees and describing refugees as a threat, unfortunately. Yeah. And what's happening right now and what we have seen in other European countries is exactly the same, where parties, decent parties, you know, serious parties, competing in portraying refugees as a big problem, a burden, in so many negative words, which means adapting the agenda of the far-right extremists. In the same time, I also have my other home country, Greece, in my mind all the time, because I wrote a book called Chaos, A Dictionary of the Crisis, and I did a theater, The Odyssey, about the crisis in Europe, the multiple crises in Europe that started with a financial crisis and then transformed into a political and democratic crisis. And there we have neo-Nazis in the parliament.
Yeah.
You know, we have Golden Dawn, and they are criminals, and they're not even, you know, trying to hide it. I think this is really a problem for Europe that we have to address together, and we have to fight this together, and we have to find ways of building bridges and initiating dialogue with these people somehow, and invite them to talk or to, you know, to change somehow. So, but my problem is that I don't think that politicians around Europe have taken the far right, the extremism and the Nazi threats serious enough.
I think one of the nice things about Europe is you can look at these problems that are kind of appearing all across Europe and then see where they're being dealt with the best. And an example I found when I was researching this story was that in Germany, there's this organization called Exit Deutschland, which seems to be doing amazing work at helping recovering neo-Nazis. They've got some really original ideas, like they hand out t-shirts, supposedly neo-Nazi t-shirts at rallies, that when they then put them in the washing machine, the initial text rubs off and it tells them where they could get help if they want to recover.
Oh, that's amazing.
You're so intelligent.
Isn't it incredible? They seem like an amazing organization. They're run by an ex-police officer and an ex-neo-Nazi together.
Wow.
I just thought I'd wrap up by saying there are some people doing amazing work out there, and we just need to give them more oxygen and find more funding for them as well, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally true. But I also think that we have to work on many different levels, to work on the courage and on very early at schools and teach kids what it's all about and teach kids how to recognize signals and symbols and also this very, very infected debate going on that we really, because we have people that are, that fear to express their opinion because they know if they say anything on Twitter, for example, you know, that is like, oh, if you dare to write things on Twitter, like I'm for human rights, the next moment you're harassed by racist trolls saying, oh, you're a bitch, you should die, you should be raped and things like that. And it's terrible because there are so many and they obviously have too much time. And I have so many, especially women writing to me, saying like I had to leave the democratic arena of Twitter because I was so harassed. So I think it begins earlier than, you know, having like Nazis on the streets, you know, in black uniforms. I think we have to start the catharsis and try to work on a decent democratic dialogue much earlier.
Are you still in touch with Martin now, Alexandra? Have you spoken to him? Do you know if he's doing okay?
Yes, he's doing great. I called him last night, in fact, and we're friends. We're talking. The other day I received a threat and I published it on my Instagram. It was somebody who was like, oh, I wish your daughter is going to be gang raped by Muslims or whatever. And Martin was, in fact, the first person to call me and say, hey, this is terrible. I'm so sad for what's happening to you. And we're going to give a speech together in a couple of weeks. And he's fighting to find his place and his new identity because, as you know, it's not something happening overnight that you suddenly wake up and you're, you know, and I think, I mean, I have to work on my prejudice, even if I've dedicated my life to this. I walk around and I just notice my own racist thoughts here and there. So I think this is a daily struggle for all of us.
But I think it's amazing what you've done. Like, so few people would think if somebody gets in touch after years of tormenting someone, oh, you know what? Let's meet up for coffee. I just think you've been amazingly brave about the whole thing.
Yeah, and able to call him your friend. It's amazing.
Yeah, but it's so funny because everybody's, my God, you're so brave. How did you dare doing this? But, you know, it was an egoistic act because I feel free now. I can't carry the burden of hating a person that made my life a mess and, a nightmare. I mean, I feel so much happier forgiving him and forgiving anybody else who asks me to forgive them. So I really hope he's only the first of many, many, many to come. And it's not brave, it's just, I was brave that I had to handle all this shit through all these years. It's not brave to forgive, it's so much nicer. And I'm really, really proud and happy to call him a friend today.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.